Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. The Commonwealth Club can be visited at www.commonwealthclub.org. Many of our lectures, if not almost all of the last few years, are available online. And I'd also like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And I'd like to introduce Tara Smith, the author of this wonderful book, very detailed and nice and abstract. I can see that many people still like abstract ideas. Judicial Review in an Objective Legal System. Tara is a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas in Austin. She's the author of Moral Rights and Political Freedom, Viable Values, A Study of Life as the Root and Reward of Morality, and also Ayn Rand's Normative Ethics, The Virtuous Egoist. Her writings have been translated into several languages, including Chinese, Japanese, and Hebrew. And she has a very interesting argument about how the different strands of thought in legal arguments about what judicial review should constitute, she takes all three of the major strands and then makes her own conclusion. Thank you very much for coming, Tara.
Thank you very much. So the mic's okay? Good, good. Thank you very much for having me. And thank you all very much for coming out. I have to begin by asking, who are you? Who comes to a talk like this? Seriously, you know, you like to know who you're talking to. Lawyers? How many of you are lawyers or work in the legal profession? I'm just sort of curious, if you don't mind. My God, and you're not lawyers and you're here. Wow. It's wonderful that you have this humanities philosophy series. We're not used to that. The only mistake, though, is doing it on a Monday night. As a philosopher who's also a football fan, I would say you might want to try Tuesday night. That's about the only night that's still quiet from football. Even tonight, there's some football on. There's some college. Well, there is also baseball on. Unless I need this later, I'm going to set this aside just to give myself. Oh, thank you. Okay. All right. My subject is the same subject as my book, Objectivity in Judicial Review, which is potentially a somewhat arid topic. So let's just remind ourselves, first of all, what is judicial review again? Judicial review is the process of courts resolving disputes about what the law means. More specifically, about what our law, our constitution, our fundamental bedrock law, permits the government to do and forbids the government from doing. So, for instance, does our Second Amendment mean that I shouldn't need a license to own a gun? Does the Fourth Amendment mean that the police need a warrant to search him that way, you know, on that street? Courts, in judicial review, courts review the laws or government actions that have been questioned, that have been challenged, challenged as not legal, as having broken the rules that the Constitution sets, right? So that's what judicial review is. So who cares? I mean, why should we care, right? Why should the average citizen care about this? Well, basically because it's here in the understanding of the law at its most general and most abstract, as the constitutional law is, right? It's here in the understanding of that and the application of that that the law will actually touch us, flesh and blood human beings, right? This is the practical end of these abstract rules that we enact, how they affect actual people. Does the president's executive authority, you know, executive power, sounds pretty abstract. Okay, does that mean that he can unilaterally alter the legal status of immigrants? The answer makes a big difference to the immigrants and a lot of other people, right? Equal protection clause of the 14th Amendment, does that imply that I can marry my partner and enjoy all the same legal benefits as other married couples or not? Makes a big difference to real people, okay? Even the best-made laws, right? Dream for a second, right? Imagine all the laws are well-made. They're just what they should be. Okay, but even they, if they're misunderstood, if they're misconstrued and misapplied, they're not going to do what they should be doing. What they should be doing is protecting us, protecting our rights, protecting our freedom, right? Basic idea of a proper legal system, you make the right rules such that you're respecting people's autonomy, people's freedom to go about leading their own lives, pursuing their own happiness. Obviously, if you mess up the design of those laws, those rules, that's not going to happen. But equally, again, even under the best-made laws, badly made interpretations and applications of those laws is going to screw things up, to put it very technically. Okay. Now, while we've had heated debates in this country for several decades now, at least probably going back to the Bork, if any of you remember the name Robert Bork in the late 80s, right, going back at least until then, we've had heated debates about the proper ways to interpret the Constitution. On all sides, people would agree that the role of judicial review is to uphold the law, keep the laws, the rules, as what actually governs. They differ on how to do that, but they agree that is what we should be after. Let me skip that. The question, though, is do courts do that? Do they actually uphold the law? And here, a lot of people would say no. They would quite readily and quite confidently say, no, that's not what our courts do. It's all just politics, common complaint, right? They do what they want to do according to their own ideological leanings. We've heard these complaints. Oh, those two were appointed by the Republicans, so what do you expect? Or she was just a political token, right? Especially in cases where the stakes are high and the public's differences are keen. Think about the Affordable Care Act or gay marriage or gun rights and so on. In such cases, people often assume that judges simply indulge their preferences, camouflaged by a little intricate legalese, right? This isn't just a popular perception. Increasingly, you have law professors themselves espousing these ideas. A professor at Georgetown has said that the Constitution, I mean, he said this in print, in a book. He wasn't just, you know, he didn't have a little too much wine this night. Okay, this was his considered opinion. The Constitution is merely a symbol meant to evoke a mood. But it gives us no more definitive instruction than that. Down at UC Irvine, just down the road a piece from here, right? UC Irvine, the dean there, has said, quote, there is no such thing as objective constitutional law. Judges, justices, have voiced similar opinions. Justice Posner, if anybody is familiar with that, very prolific and influential judge. On the Supreme Court, you wouldn't expect it of Samuel Alito, but he has said this kind of thing about the concept of liberty in particular. All of which I raise because I do think it's disturbing. How can we maintain the rule of law and enjoy its stability and enjoy its justice if people no longer believe that it's possible? If we cynically toss off, oh, it's all just politics. Amidst such skepticism, it's easy to despair. And it's fashionable to despair, right? You sound sophisticated when, oh, we know, they're not pulling the wool over our eyes, right? It's natural to wonder, the title of my talk tonight, can the courts get the law right? Can a judge be objective, faithful to the law, regardless of his own particular advocacy of that law, right? Can he accept, this is the law that I am charged to enforce, right? Can a judge be objective? Yes, I think so. It's not easy, but it's definitely doable. The problem for judicial review is not that objectivity is unattainable, nor that judges are a corrupt breed, partisans in robes. The problem is that we often don't fully understand what objectivity is and what it demands in this realm. Consequently, even those wishing to uphold objective law fail because they misunderstand it. So we certainly won't have objective law if we're not convinced that it is attainable, and if we don't have a good grip on what it is. So that's what I want to talk about tonight. I'm going to talk for a little while simply about objectivity. Again, an abstract topic, but a really important one. Just want to talk a little bit about trying to clarify what it is and isn't, and then correlatively talk a little while about objectivity in judicial review, what that is and isn't. I hope that by puncturing the mystique of these things a little bit, we can gain a more sensible conception of what is possible and what we should be demanding in order to uphold the rule of law. Okay. Objectivity. So this is where it sounds like a philosophy class for a little while. What is objectivity? Now, it's a familiar term. It's not one of these technical terms you didn't get until you took a certain course in college, right? We're familiar with the basic idea from early on in life. But don't ask most people to define it. I mean, we'd all get pretty uncomfortable if you asked for a definition of objectivity. You know the old saw about pornography that a judge once said, you know, I know it when I see it. When it comes to objectivity, most people know it when they don't see it. That was biased. That was prejudiced. That was favoritism. We're quite confident in those judgments, right? Okay, but what is it that we want? What is objectivity? I think it's helpful to step back for a minute to think, why do we even want objectivity in any realm? Why do we care about objectivity? What are we looking for? What do we want out of this concept? So think about objectivity in other realms. Leave the law aside for a minute, right? Why do we want objectivity in hiring decisions or in college admissions decisions or from journalists or people on a jury? From drug researchers, right? We want them, they're checking out the efficacy of drugs. We want them to go about their business objectively, right? We want the referees on the playing fields on Monday Night Football and so on, right? We want them being objective. Why do we want it in these various realms? Basically, because we want the people involved to reach true conclusions and make good decisions, if decisions are what's at stake there, right? About whom to hire, whom to admit to the university or whatnot, right? When we complain that a person or a procedure wasn't objective, we mean that it didn't reach its conclusions on the right basis, by the appropriate factors. They didn't evaluate the job candidates in the way that they should have. They weren't paying attention to the relevant stuff or the most important stuff, right? They didn't evaluate the drugs on the right basis. Call it like you see it, we tell the refs, right? Call it like you see it, not like the home crowd wants you to see it. Not like you've been paid to see it, right? Call it like you see it and strive to see it the way it really is, right? We are not, any football fan or sports fans out there, right? You're not satisfied if the ref calls it like he sees it from the comfort of, you know, his position 30 yards downfield. We want him hustling down the goddamn field, right? We want him hustling so that he can really get the best angle and see what really happened. But in principle, I think that's helpful, right? Objectivity, you're trying to get it right. You're trying to understand the reality, whether it's the reality of this drug or what happened on the field or who is qualified for this job or to be a good, you know, a student who can succeed in this program. You're trying hard to get it right. We care about objectivity because there's something we care about getting right. The right calls made to enforce the rules, the right students admitted to the school, the drugs, the medicines that are effective and safe. So what is objectivity? That's a little bit about why we care about it. It's a method. It's a way of using our minds. It's the method that's geared to getting things right. Understanding things accurately, understanding things fully as they actually are. Objectivity is a systematic process, you might say. It's a deliberate discipline for using your mind. A little bit more specifically, it's the discipline that adheres to facts and logic. Those are its tools in its quest to understand the given object in question, whether the drug is effective, whether the player was out of bounds, whether the student is qualified or equipped to do the work, right? So there's an object. Again, the object might be a physical thing. It might be qualities of a person, but there's an object you want to understand as accurately and fully as possible. Objectivity is the way to use your mind going by facts and logic that best positions you to succeed in that quest, okay? Just a minute more on this. Think for a minute about perhaps the paradigm of objectivity, the scientific method. Can you dust that off from fifth grade when you learned all those conditions about the scientific method, right? Remember that? Observe meticulously, and I'm not going to go through them all, don't worry. But remember, you know, observe and vary the conditions and repeat your experiment. What's all that rigmarole about? Why go through all of those different conditions to be scientific? In the quest to get it right, right? What you're trying to do, again, is get the, accurately understand the object, the way things are. So in the book, as I elaborate much further, I try to give a realistic account of objectivity, you know, that's accessible, that's understandable, that's recognizable, based on what our minds can and can't do. And here, for now, one important important clarification. Objectivity, to claim that some, you know, conclusion of yours is objective, isn't to claim infallibility. Being objective, you know, using the right logical methods, it doesn't guarantee that you won't have made a mistake. Nothing will guarantee that. Think for a minute, just to try to illustrate with an example. Think for a minute about a jury. It is possible that a given jury all deliberated absolutely, conscientiously, meticulously, rationally, and logically, and objectively, and still reached an incorrect verdict. Through no fault of their own, perhaps because some piece of evidence didn't come to light, wasn't available until after they rendered their verdict, right? They could have been completely objective, but being objective, again, it's not some sort of money-back guarantee to a metaphysical kind of certainty or omniscience or infallibility that nothing can give us. But being objective, disciplining your thinking about an issue by the relevant facts and logic, is the only means whereby we can know whereof we speak. Okay. So that's the spiel on objectivity for now. Again, if you want more detail, a lot more about what it's not, I do go into that in the book. But let me now turn to objectivity in judicial review. Here, when thinking about the law, the interpretation of the law, our compass, I think, must be the function of judicial review, which is to ensure that it is the law that governs, to understand correctly what the law requires and forbids and how that applies in the disputed cases about equal protection or immigration or searches or speech or whatever it might be. Essentially, objectivity in judicial review demands two things, I think. Unswerving focus on the law. That's the object in question. Again, to use that sort of metaphor that I've been using, there's this object. That's the relevant object here, baby. Focus on the law and only the law. Unswerving focus there. And then second, appreciation of the contextual character of law's meaning. So I'm going to spend the rest of my remarks elaborating on each of these two things, okay? I want to start with the second one, the contextual character of meaning. I told you this was abstract. Sorry. There is a comedian speaking shortly, so I will understand if a few of you want to go upstairs. I'll try not to take it personally. You're free to go. The contextual character of meaning. What am I talking about here? A person must understand the mission of a legal system overall. You've got to understand the mission of the system and the authority of that system in order to properly construe any of its discrete elements, any of its discrete rules or laws. In a proper legal system, all of its parts and powers, specific rules and policies are reflections of a central animating purpose. Their legitimacy depends on that. Correspondingly, their legitimate meaning depends on that. A legal system's authority determines what its particular provisions could possibly mean in order to be consistent with that authority, and what they could not mean, since certain interpretations of the laws would exceed the government's authority, allowing the government a power that it doesn't rightfully possess. Example, the right to free speech couldn't protect speech that fraudulently misrepresents another person, since that speech would be a violation of that other guy's rights, right? Different example, freedom of religion. It couldn't protect the rape of women in the name of my faith, right? Or beating the hell out of children to discipline them in the name of my faith, because those actions, again, would infringe on others' rights. The point is, you have to get the whole picture right. Again, the mission, the authority of the legal system as a whole, you have to understand that overarching function in order to then understand the proper meaning of any single component, the right to free speech, the meaning of the First Amendment, or what have you. People often observe that the application of legal abstractions to actual cases can be difficult. You bet, it can be, for sure, right? Quick example here. 14th Amendment speaks of equal protection of the laws, while the First Amendment promises the free exercise of religion Okay, so how do you reconcile these when the religious baker doesn't want to cater the gay couple's wedding, right? That's complicated. But the solution isn't to resort to a living constitution, a changing constitution that we update as we go, right, as we so-called apply it. Rather, it requires the reconciliation of these or figuring out what should happen legally. That requires that we attend to the philosophy that animates this constitution, its theory of rights, its principles. So the Constitution is alive, in a sense. I use that term animating deliberately, consciously. Yeah, it's animated. It's animated with an informing philosophy. And to objectively uphold its laws is in part to honor that philosophy. Now, lest this sound a little bit like, ooh, where's she coming from on this? I don't think this is such an exotic idea. That is, that context matters to the proper understanding of the words on a page. In many areas in life, we readily distinguish the letter of the law from the spirit of the law, right? We know that in all sorts of realms. We're not just talking about laws like government-made laws, right? Which is a way of recognizing that context affects meaning, that the background and purpose of a rule illuminate its proper application. Again, an example from the non-legal realm. I'm a professor. I write a syllabus at the beginning of every course, right? And I have some rules on the syllabus about how late work will be penalized. You know, here are the deadlines, when the assignments are due, the papers, the exams, blah, blah. And I tell you, and if your work is late, the grade will be docked. And the later it is, the lower the grade goes. So, why do I do that? Because I think that's what's fair. Not to give you 2 weeks more because I like your face or whatever it might. No, everybody in the class gets the same deadline, right? Yet, certain reasons for late work, I do forgive without penalty. You know, your father has a heart attack the night before, you slip on the ice and break your leg the night before the thing is due. Why do I make those exceptions? Because the rule wasn't designed to rule out bad luck. It was designed to, you know, not help you avoid the basic requirements of the class or get more time than others, you know, unfair advantage, that sort of thing. But it's not designed to tell against, you know, obviously, once in a while, extraordinary, horrible circumstances or bad luck, right? So I interpret the law, and I think few would have issue with this, on the basis of the whole reason for having the law in the first place. Again, which is to say, the letter of the law, including the legal law, the government law, the letter can't be understood without understanding the spirit, without understanding the purpose and principles of the larger legal system. Context matters to objective meaning. The law is philosophical. You heard it here from the philosopher first, right? But the law is philosophical. Our Constitution in the U.S. certainly reflects a definite theory of government in creating the powers that it does, as well as in those it doesn't create, as well as in its structuring of powers and the safeguards it builds in. It is taking a stand on what it sees as the proper relationship between the government and the governed. Correspondingly, courts in judicial review, when they're trying to understand the law, must make use of that idea about the proper relationship when considering the meaning of disputed laws. This entails that objectivity in judicial review requires judgment on the part of judges. But that's exactly where a lot of people balk. A lot of people get nervous when you start talking about judges, actually, excuse me, I'm now going to use this dirty word, judge. Right? We get, oh, no, they can't judge objectively. They're going to judge politically or ideologically or whatever part, right? Critics of activist courts often imply that judicial review should be a no-brainer, right? With the answer self-evident. Right rulings are just common sense. But the problem is, it can't be just common sense. To understand the correct application of abstract concepts to particular circumstances is an intellectual process, a demanding one, often a difficult one. Consider, did the police have probable cause for that stop, for that search? Is it freedom of the press to withhold that information from the government investigation of that terrorist ring? Is that refusal to do business, to cater those two women's wedding? Is that the free exercise of religion or the violation of equal protection for them? I'm not trying to answer any of these questions right now. I'm just trying to say that to answer them, you have to think. You have to reason. Judicial review isn't a game of Simon Says, of mindless obedience to the self-evident, to common sense. No, it's a difficult thinking process. And we can't convert this fallible process into some sort of foolproof method that would guarantee the right results. So while it's certainly right-minded to insist that courts honor the law, what was written and enacted, that's extremely important, right? It's also important to appreciate what can't be written. Meaning. This is a subtle point, but I think it's really important. Meaning can be indicated by words, but it's not contained in words. It's not reducible to words. You might put it this way. Rules can be written. The understanding of those rules can't be. That's in here. That's in minds. And that's why we need judges. That's why we need human beings to think, to weigh logically, to exercise objective judgment about the proper meaning of laws in their full context. The judge's role is not that of a visionary with special insight who can just see the right answers, nor that of a rubber stamp to acquiesce whatever the other branches have already said on a given issue. Determining how the abstract concepts that are included in our laws, search, speech, equal protection, and so on, to determine how those apply in particular cases, that is a demanding intellectual activity. And it's a mistake to condemn judges for inserting their judgments when they engage in that activity. We should complain when they're not objective about doing so, but not the sheer fact of their, using their judgment. That doesn't constitute being an activist or an overly active judge. Okay. All right, let me move on, because I do want to allow some time for questions. Let me move on to the first of the two guideposts. I said two main things for objectivity in judicial review, right? And I spoke about the second one first, appreciating the contextual, the larger function and authority of the law to understand meaning. Now let me come to the first one, which is the one that can sound so obvious, right? Unswerving focus on the law, I said. I mean, that sounds so simple. So what? Who would disagree with that? Of course, judges should pay attention to the law. But that's much easier said than done. And it's much easier said than supported by people who pay lip service to the rule of law, but who want their piece of the pie, right? And who lobby for all sorts of ancillary goodies that aren't legally authorized. So when I say focus on the law, judges, if you're going to be objective, focus on the law. As opposed to what? As opposed to what else? What else might take their eye off the ball here, right? Well, a number of things, once you think about it. Things that the law is not, but that courts are frequently urged to heed, to pay attention to, and to follow. So I'm going to give you a few. I talk about even a few more in the book. Though I do want to issue a caution first. Some of the things I'm about to sort of indict as distractions from the law, there are circumstances in which they're legit, okay? I'm not trying to say, and anytime you hear this word, that's bad news, that's non-objective, that's an abuse of judicial power, okay? I'm not trying to say every time you hear any of these, they're wrong. But I am raising them because characteristically, more often than not, typically, they are inserted into discussions of how courts should rule, how they should reason and reach their conclusions in ways that are not objective and that take the judge's eyes and concern off the law. So, what sorts of things do I have in mind? One, an objective court must be wary of calls for balance. We frequently hear, we must balance the religious people's liberty interests with the gay couple's equality interests, or the homeowner's rights with the community's interests, or national security and civil liberties, right? I mean, balance, we hear about balance all the time. And as soon as I say that, you think, who can be a bank? Where did they get this person? She is from Texas, isn't she, right? Who could be again? And I'm not a native. And unlike many, I didn't get there as soon as I could. But I got there, and it's very nice. But that's another story. New Jersey, just if you want to. They're not wondering. They don't care. No. Anyway, who could be against balance, right? Balance, it sounds so soothing and so moderate and so reasonable. Okay. And what does it mean? When we say the court should balance these, what are we really asking or telling the court to do? It's often invoked as a nebulous term which exudes the aura of reasoned moderation, but is employed, again, frequently in ways that subvert the primacy of law. So whenever you hear about balance, you should be wary, at least, right, especially in this context of judicial review, and ask a few important questions, like, how are we to balance the different ends here? What would constitute an acceptable balance? What's the commensurable good that we are supposed to be balancing here? We should balance what exactly and for what end, right? What is the greater good that will be served by the balancing here? There may be good answers to some of these questions. We typically never even raise the question, so we don't hear the answers, right? And you need good answers to these questions. And maybe most fundamentally, we should balance by what standard? And what does that standard have to do with what the law is? I mean, the main thought here is simply this. A court should never balance the law with anything else, because to do that is to subordinate the law. That's not to uphold the rule of law. Okay. A second frequent distraction from the law, keeping your focus on the law, the popularity of certain rulings or the expected popularity of this ruling or that ruling. Now, courts will not come out and say, we'll just do whatever the latest polls tell us you all want. No, courts don't typically say that. But they're often pressed, and justices themselves and the kinds of interviews that they give scattered throughout the year, I gather here, Sotomayor is on one of the brochures here at the Commonwealth Club, right? I mean, and judges will themselves sometimes reveal in interviews that they are concerned with things like, well, would this ruling enjoy mainstream support? Would that kind of ruling in the abortion case, would that be divisive? Right? Is the country ready for this kind of ruling about immigration or guns or whatever? We hear that language all the time, right? But what does that amount to? What does public opinion think about this right now? But public opinion, the divisiveness or the social harmony that might respond to a given reaction, that's something other than what the law is, what the existing law is and what the existing law means. And what I'm saying is objective judicial review means you focus on the law. If certain laws should be changed, there are constitutional ways of doing that. But it's not for judicial review or for the courts to do that. Okay, one or two others. Size. A lot of people in recent years are concerned with the size of rulings. We hear things like judges should minimize their footprint, their imprint on the law. They should leave the democratic branches to rule, and they should try to minimize the scope of their rulings, the impact that their rulings will have. Minimalists is the name given to this approach, which interestingly spans the political spectrum. You have people on the far right and the far left and in the middle all espousing these minimalist ideas. Everybody from, you'll hear Kennedy and Alito and Roberts. I mean, they're all over the place. Okay. Problem here. Laws have differing scopes, and the application, the upholding of some laws in practice will have big ramifications, and of other laws, small ramifications. But that depends on the law. The impact of a given ruling depends on the scope of the law, not court's manipulation, or it shouldn't, on court's manipulating to have this kind of effect or that kind of effect. To insist on one size fits all, always make your rulings have small, limited impact, is to ignore what the actual law is. Let the consequences fall where they may. Okay? I'm going to skip one, I think, and just move to one more. This one is very entrenched, and this is where I get the most pushback from lawyers. So lawyers out there, you know, have at it if you want. One of the most entrenched and respected rivals, I think, to objective law is regard for precedent. Now, here again, you need to be careful. There's much to be said for precedent, but not as much as is often thought. It's important to, and by precedent, basically, I mean previous courts' rulings. You know, courts will often say, well, the court said this in this case 15 years ago, or the court has said this five times in these other previous cases over the, therefore, who are we to change it? Precedent, that is the law. I mean, that is a widely accepted doctrine among constitutional interpreters. We must go by what the precedent is. I mean, I'm sure you've all read the complaint about, I mean, one of the complaints about Citizens United is, oh, it overturned precedent, as if precedents may never be overturned. Now, that's another, you know, talk about that more if you like, but basically, it is important to recognize the difference between the law, the existing law at a given time and what it means, and what previous people, including previous justices of the Supreme Court, have thought it means. Those aren't the same thing. Objective review demands that courts discard mistaken precedents of legal interpretation as the law. They're not. And in the wonderful words of Justice Frankfurter, quote, the ultimate touchstone of constitutionality is the Constitution itself and not what we have said about it, close quote. Now, again, let me acknowledge some of the things I've just mentioned, you know, balance, social harmony, and so on. These are nice things. These are good things. These are wonderful, admirable ends in many circumstances, but not for discerning the law, what the existing law is and means. All of these bypass that, elevating extraneous goals above it. Thus, again, my claim, objective review demands scrupulous adherence to the law. We're to be governed by the Constitution, not the Constitution, plus a few other things that some of us find desirable. Okay, all of this is a teaser. If you really are interested in these issues, you might want to look at my book in more depth. There's a kind of a coupon back there, a thing to get 20% off if you wanted to order the book. And I do in the book go into a lot, I go into actually like five of the dominant schools of thought these days, a couple of species of originalism and living constitutionalism and minimalism. I go into several of these in a lot of depth. And I try as well to elaborate more on how objective review might work in practice. Okay. I hope for now, at least, though, that I've motivated you somewhat to be more thoughtful than popular discourse often is in, you know, its sound bites and its slogans about what and who we should want on the high courts. The work that they do, yeah, incredibly important for translating, again, even the best-made laws when they are well-made, into practice. Whether or not our freedoms are protected hinges on this, so I do think we need to pay attention to what's going down as proper review so that, you know, if we have a realistic understanding of what it is, we know what to demand and we know what we should be demanding, and hopefully with some of that work we can do a better job of getting it. So we do have some time for questions. Thank you. And thanks. So, sure, but they do want you to use the mic, whether you go up there right, or it comes to you. Okay.
It'll come to you.
And this, just so you know, George, this woman after this gentleman.
Great. So I'd like to remind our audiences that are listening to Tara Smith speaking about objectivity and judicial review at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. It's time for our questions and answers.
So when we look at the American Constitution, it's necessarily, you could say, vague. Yes, there was a spirit when they designed it. There was a clear spirit on it. So then the question is, if the Constitution doesn't specifically say certain things and you have conflicts between different things, why are you against a living Constitution in the sense that you amend it, that you make it, that you adapt it to the times, that you take care of things it couldn't have regulated, rather than doing it all with judicial review? Because even with judicial review, when you make those rulings, you can try to be objective, but necessarily you're always going to be influenced by the individual circumstances of when that ruling happened, or the individual person that ruled it, and so on.
Okay. Interesting question. Let me say a few things to try to clarify my view. I have nothing against amending the Constitution. It's a, you know, one of the articles of the Constitution talks about, it explicitly addresses how to amend this Constitution. If later, you know, from the time it was enacted, people decide we'd rather change this, that, or the other thing about it. There's a constitutional means of doing that, and I'm all for that. I have nothing against amendments in principle. What I'm against is judicial review being used to do the amending, because what it says about amending is not, oh, and the courts may do this when they have a better idea. So I'm not against amending the Constitution. I'm against courts taking it upon themselves. They are to apply, uphold the existing law. As long as it remains the existing law, that's the law they've got to apply. Now, I don't think, I think we're sometimes, now here's the philosopher in me perhaps, but I wouldn't say the Constitution is vague. It talks in abstractions. It talks of the free exercise of religion. It talks of a search or freedom of speech. These are these are concepts that need to be filled in with particulars, but freedom of speech is not the same thing as freedom of property, and there's no vagueness there, right? We know what religion is roughly, but lo and behold, Mormonism didn't exist in 1789. So does that mean that Mormonism doesn't get religious protection? I mean, that's the kind of question, right? That's exactly the kind of question that's raised by judicial review. Well, my theory, as I elaborated, the objective theory of meaning of concepts would say, no, if Mormonism or some new, you know, compared to 1789 when the Constitution was, you know, written and adapted and so on, right? If there are newfangled religions that really are religions, you know, they walk like a duck and they talk like a duck and they share the essential characteristics, then that concept, objectively understood, applies to these things that didn't exist back then. That's fine, that's proper, but that's going by the objective nature of the concepts that were named in the Constitution. Another quick example, freedom of speech. Talk on the telephone? They didn't have telephones back then. Freedom of commerce, online shopping. You know, we just went to the butcher or wherever we went in 1789 or what have you. Online shopping. But if it's still a form of shopping, it's covered by commerce or what have you, right? So I think, and again, I go into in depth what is an objective meaning. And here I do. I draw a lot from the epistemological thought of Ayn Rand. She had a really interesting theory of concepts that helps us understand how concepts are open, the meaning of concepts, meaning of commerce or speech or what have you, is open to correction and refinement and advances in knowledge that's still compatible with the objective meaning. So that's a long-winded answer that doesn't even get at everything in your question, but I think I should probably take a few more questions rather than go on. Thanks.
So, I mean, I understand that I think the word would be elastic, that the Constitution is very elastic so that it can somewhat change with the times. But that sort of, to me, upends the whole precedent thing. I mean, obviously, when precedent supports your argument, it's great precedent. But I have a problem with precedents for that reason, is because I don't care what they did in 1862 if it doesn't really apply to today in the same way. So, I mean, I don't know how you distinguish law versus elasticity.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, okay. And that's a tricky one. I mean, again, I'm glad you raised this. Let me first just say something on precedent. I think, you know, your casual comment is quite right-minded about people love precedent when it's a good precedent or when they regard it as a good precedent. And precedent doesn't look so good when the previous precedent or the precedent before the one they like wasn't so. I mean, if we're just supposed to go by precedent, then why do we have interracial marriage? Because before we had the Loving v. Virginia decision that gave us interracial marriage, the precedent was no such marriage. So wasn't it a radical overturning of precedent? Oh, but nobody says that, right? So I think you're right that people like precedent until they don't. And precedent looks better or worse, depending on which examples you choose. Was the precedent of Korematsu, right? The internment of Asian Americans during World War II. Was that a precedent we want to keep? No, it was a precedent that was wrong. Wrong by the objective meaning of person. Not just wrong because they, and here's where I do think it's important that words have objective meaning. Just as I was saying, look, to be objective isn't to be infallible. It isn't to be subject to no future correction, okay? But there's a meaning of the term person. And if they didn't understand that fully or correctly in 1864 or 1789 or 1920, and if we don't understand it correctly today, confident as we might be that we have a better grip on it than they did 100 years ago, okay, let us be corrected whenever people can correct us, when they can give, you know, an objective case for why, you know, it applies to these people too. They are people, not animals or whatever it might be, okay? But I think, so I wouldn't use the term elasticity. We've got to be open to correction, to refinement, to extension of knowledge. So it's a system of objective meaning is a system that is open to the objective growth of knowledge and understanding our concepts accordingly. Again, more detail in the book, but interesting observations. Yeah.
Hi. I'm not a philosopher, nor am I a lawyer.
You're like a normal person.
I'm actually a scientist, and I think much better from example to generalization rather than the other way around. So I wonder if this isn't too large a question. If you'd be so kind to say, how is it that the first phrase of the Second Amendment has disappeared? How is that consistent with the context that we know more about now that we've read Hamilton, and with the precedent, but specifically with objectivity. Thanks very much.
Okay, I'm not sure I fully get the question. So, in terms of the Second Amendment, you mean the kind of preface, a well-regulated militia being right? How'd that go away? Interesting question. Tell you the truth, the Second Amendment isn't one I've spent a lot of time on. You know, there are some examples I use more often and so on, and the Second Amendment is not one. But here's a little bit of what I understand about the Second Amendment. This is secondhand in the sense of I'm relying on a few scholars and I haven't read deeply on the Second Amendment. But I gather that such prefaces were frequently used in constitutions in that era, you know, in state constitutions, so other ones in the colonial and then early American experience, and they weren't seen as binding or as really governing the meaning of what followed. Now, that sounds odd, you know, given current practice, so I would raise my eyebrows too. I'm raising them, okay? What some historical scholars tell us is it was common to have those kind of things, to include that kind of prefatory language, which sounds to our ears like it restricts how you're supposed to take what follows, but it didn't at the time. That wasn't common practice. But it would also simply be more of a historical question to address how did we get from there to here? I don't know. I mean, it might be, and let me say two different things sort of on either side of the issue here. I mean, it might be the result of the kind of politicization or whatever you want to call it, the non-objective interpretation of law that I'm complaining about. It might be objective interpretation of law. There are many people, and actually some scholars who were not themselves fans of gun rights and who are known to be relatively left-wing scholars, such as Akhil Amar at Yale or Sanford Levinson at UT Austin, actually went in and did a lot of historical research on the Second Amendment and came to the conclusion, you know, they did mean, and the law, that Second Amendment does mean a right to private individuals to bear arms. Now, that's something we can amend if we want to. You know, I might want to. I live in Texas, and now we have guns on campus. So, you know, I mean, but until we amend it, it would be a different thing anyway.
I'm going to follow up on that with another example so that you can go from an example to the generalization, because you have the intersection of this focus on the law and, you know, the judicial application of constitutional law to the law. Sometimes people are not going to see the difference between applying the law and the constitutional law that overthrows certain laws when you focus on the law, and precedent. So let's go to the future and say that in 2017 a law is passed that all Muslims need to be eliminated from the country or move out of the country. And what would you say an objective you know, review of the intersection between focusing on the law. The law is written very clearly, and that's what it says, to the constitutional laws that get in the way of that law, and also to the precedent you mentioned about Korematsu.
Let me first answer without precedent in the mix. A given law, legislation, let's say, I mean, we also have agency-made law and sort of executive-made policy, but let's stick with the easy case or relatively straightforward case. Okay, legislation, right? A statute is enacted by the Congress and, you know, both houses of Congress and the president signs it. It can be very clear in what it, you know, very clear and very easily objectively understood what it means and what it tells us to do. But in order for it to be legal in our legal system, given that everything's got to be compatible with the Constitution, given that our Constitution says this is the supreme arbiter of law in our country, right, the sort of local clarity or objectivity or ready intelligibility of a given piece of legislation, that's not the last word on what should be done. If it's found via something like the 14th Amendment, the, you know, again, animating philosophy, the through line that connects all of the rights that are specified in the Constitution, as well as, extremely importantly, the 9th Amendment, which some of you may remember, is that amendment that says, the sheer fact that we haven't named something here as a right doesn't mean you don't have it, right? You retain all of your natural rights. We're just listing a few to give you some examples of the sorts of things that we're going to protect, right? But that itself, that reference to other rights, so we'd need to know, on what basis are you saying Muslims per se, simply in virtue of the fact that they profess that faith, right, would not have these same rights? So you'd have to go to that broader level of some constitutional provisions to get how this may be clear, but it's incompatible with, right? And precedence, on my view, would be beside the point of how to figure that out.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. What would be the result of the application of your methodology to what the court did in Caroline Products footnote 4, where it basically exited the field of substantive review of economic regulation to protect economic liberty and said, we're getting out of here? And assuming that your methodology would find that to be abdication problematic, what practical hope in the world would you have that a rigorous application of your methodology today has any chance of being implemented, given that the country we live in is one between that decision was made in 1937. The ensuing decades has seen just a proliferation of the administrative state, the regulatory state, the redistributive state. The people who want more and more redistribution. I mean, I view it as a one-way ratchet. There's sort of no going back just as a practical political matter.
Let me say a couple
things.
That's
why you have all these people who are like spend a lot of time trying to explain what the court's done. Like Larry Tribe used to try. He finally gave up. And he's like, this is just what people want.
Let me say a couple of things. And for those of you who aren't lawyers or scholars of the law, I don't want to get too into the inside baseball here, but your question, you've certainly... you've certainly correctly drawn inferences about where my view would go. I think Caroline Products was terrible, and I talk briefly about this in the book, and I'm actually right now writing a paper on the rational basis test that sort of came out of that. So you scope out perfectly logically... good objective job, sort of some of the implications of my view, right? And one of the things that this 1937 decision that the gentleman is referring to does is basically the court says, you know, we're going to, I mean, I'm speaking a little roughly now, but basically we're going to treat some rights as more important than others. And we're going to really be much more scrutinizing of is this constitutional, this action, let's say, that the government has just taken. We're going to be much more scrutinizing if it's these kind of rights that are in play rather than those kinds of rights. I argue there's absolutely no good constitutional basis for doing that. As long as you're not infringing on his rights, it doesn't matter how you're using your rights, right? So that is a problem. because courts since have very much adopted that and doubled down and reinforced that. I will say there have been rising voices of reaction against that just in the last few years among legal scholars. And legal scholars not all on a certain political side of the equation. I was at a conference a few months ago which had scholars from across the ideological spectrum expressing a lot of skepticism about that. Not uniform, there were also a few defenders of that, but that kind of thing gives me some hope that there may be a beginning of chipping away at some of that, but I like to be hopeful. Okay.
If you were a Supreme Court justice for Citizens United, how would you have applied objective review?
Here again, I'd want to. I mean, I have to say, on the one hand, in a scholarly way, I haven't really gone into voting law much or Citizens United much. But I'll give you my potentially alienate the audience at the end kind of answer, which is to say, I like Citizens United. I think spending money is within your rights, and you know, you have the right to spend as much of your money, as long as you're not infringing on anybody else's rights, for the political candidates that, you know, give to them as much as you want to give. Money fails all the time in terms of elections. I mean, how many times have we heard, oh, Michael Huffington in California, what was it, 30 years, you know, he's got so much dough, or John Corzine, or Ross Perot, but a little bit more recently. Where's Jeb Bush today? He's the one who had all the money going into the Republican primaries. Who the hell knows where he is? This guy Trump, who may be independent, you know, on his own may be wealthy, but per voter spent a much smaller fraction. He's the guy who's got the nomination, okay? Uber in Austin, this is an embarrassment as far as I'm concerned in Austin that we got rid of Uber. But the pro-Uber forces outspent the opposition 50-1 and lost the referendum. My point there is just, it's a good soundbite, money buys elections. People aren't stupid. They listen to Obama didn't have a lot of money when he started out, but he had ideas people liked. Bernie Sanders didn't have money, but he had ideas that enough people liked and gave money to and so on. So, I mean, that's just to say a little bit about that issue. But I am a big supporter of freedom of speech, and I do think that includes the right to put your money where your beliefs are, again, as long as you're not infringing on others' rights.
Okay. In the U.S. Supreme Court, precedence and the constitutional law is very often set by a 5-4 margin, which is quite narrow. In contrast, in the German Constitutional Court, the requirement is a 2/3 majority. So suppose in the U.S., if there is a reform saying if you have just a 5-4 margin, then you may make a decision on the case, but not a precedence. And to reach something to the statute of a constitutional law, you have to have 2/3 majority, which is 6-3. Yeah. Is that going to be more robust, more healthy?
I don't know, in all honesty. There are a number of kind of, I think of them as institutional questions about how the court should be structured, how it's, you know, should it have to, you know, should 5-4 be enough? I haven't thought that through. And I think it's a good and fair question, right? When we're really thinking about what are the best ways to try to ensure objective readings and applications of our law, I think that kind of question is important, just to name maybe another. The court denies cert all the time. People want to have a case heard, and it says no without giving any reasons. Should it have to give reasons? I'm not sure, but I think that's, again, a question worth thinking about. Should it have to say at least a little something on why not? Why allow nine opinions? Should the court, whatever the vote, be it 9-0 or 5-4, should it just issue a single ruling? Should everybody have to weigh in? Even if they all, if it was a 9-0, should everybody have to say something? I mean, there are, I think, important questions that I just haven't thought through yet. But I hope to get to some of them. I really do.
I'm sorry, I just can't help following up on the First Amendment.
Yeah, okay.
One, because corporations are kind of important, and they perhaps they did not exist at the time of the writing of the Constitution, as far as I know. And I would just say one little anecdote about that, just because it's funny. I saw a sign in a protest in Washington, back of the Wall Street protest, and there was a park, and there were people there. There was a sign against a tree, and it said, "I'll believe corporations are people when they hang one in Texas."
I'm not going to give you the last word on that, though, sir. Here's my Texan again. Corporations are interesting things. Couple of just quick factoids. There are not-for-profit corporations. To be a corporation is not the equivalent of to be a for-profit. There are different species of corporations. That's something to keep in mind. The law has long recognized things other than persons as having legal standing and legal rights. When you think about property law, when you think about married couples, when you think about certain other institutions, such as a church that gets to act as an agent, a legal agent, right? It's not a corporate, it's not a person. But there are all sorts of reasons why the law has seen fit. Now, again, these are interesting questions to think about, should it or not, right? But corporations aren't the unique special pet of being able to spend money, right? I mean, there are joint bank accounts that people have. The Catholic Church in America or the Archdiocese of Boston gets to do certain things on behalf of a bunch of people in Boston and spend money as it likes on anti-abortion campaigns or what have you. So corporations, again, I think just aren't as simple as the popular discourse would often have us believe in some of these discussions.
I always find it worth noting in these discussions.
Oh, there you are.
Oh.
Sorry, I couldn't.
I always find it worth noting in these discussions of Citizens United, and people, you know, have strong views about it, that the author of Buckley v. Valeo back in the mid-70s, which first declared that speech is money, and it's subject to, and the money campaign contributions are subject to First Amendment protection, was the great Justice Brennan. So that's something
interesting. Yeah. Now, I mean, one of the interesting arguments there too was that it would be interesting, shall we say, to say you can say whatever you want, you have freedom of speech, and you can spend $100. You know, I mean, whatever the issue about which you're speaking, be it a political issue, a campaign issue, or whatever, you know, but, okay, but you can only spend $100 on your printing or your writing or so on, you know. Commonwealth Club, have a good time. Have all the speakers you want on this budget. Doesn't that, in effect, limit what you can say?
No, what limits what we can say is the time. So we have time for one more question.
I just wanted to say, it's not really a question, but I heard an interesting discussion this morning on whether the court, as it is, with only just 8 justices, is really what should be maintained. And I think that the principal argument was because right now the court is turning down a lot of cases because they know that it'll just fall down as 4-4.
Mm-hmm.
And yet if they take a case and the decision it comes down as 5-3, it's going to be actually a much more important or applicable decision because of the fact that it's coming a lot closer to that two-thirds.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and then also on the subject of whether corporations are persons, it's interesting that when you gave the example of speech of money not necessarily accomplishing anything when it comes to trying to influence elections, which is true because, like, I think Edelman has spent billions and not gotten one candidate elected ever. Mm-hmm. But you didn't mention corporations. You only mentioned persons in that argument. And I don't know whether there will ever be found to be an actual difference between a person like one of the Koch brothers and a corporation. But it's still, the ones you mentioned were only people. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting.
Okay. Let me just say something on the first issue, which is the keeping the court at 4-4, or this whole thing of having the court be 8 people for so long. I think that's terrible. And I mean, here I completely disagree with a lot of the Republicans who are championing this. I think it contributes to the politicization of the court that I'm complaining about. Right? It's treating them like and expecting them to be political hacks, as opposed to people who should be, and I think actually often are, trying to do their honest best in understanding the law. So Yeah, I think that's really poor on the part of those who have been so obstructionist about trying to have a ninth person on the court. But anyway.
And the fact is that a lot of their decisions are not 5-4. There's a lot of decisions, not just
true.
A completely
yeah. no, this is
set
true.
In stone. It's just the real controversial ones that are often that close. Yeah. yeah. Okay. So thank you very much, Tara. That was wonderful. Wonderful discussion. It's hard to get any clearer about abstract things than that. So thank you very, very much for coming. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.